Welcome to Break the Chains, America's top radio source of information for people struggling with drug or alcohol addiction and those who love them. And now, the host of Break the Chains, Gwen Cardin.
For many people who are working to remain abstinent, living in a structured, monitored situation can provide an additional safety net between rehab and going back home. Recovery residences, which are sometimes known as halfway houses or sober living and a few other names, can really be a godsend for addicts whose sobriety is likely to be threatened if they return to their old environment. The triggers, the family drama, all the bad old memories, and certainly people that they probably should never see or talk to again. But like anything else, not all recovery residences are the same. Some operate to a very high standard and closely monitor residents and appropriately support them, while others don't follow best practices, and they can become another conduit for people who aren't serious about their sobriety to meet other like-minded or fragile or easily derailed people. So what should you know and what do you need to consider when deciding on a recovery residence for you or for someone you love? What are some of the red flags that should send you running down the street, suitcase in hand, before you ever even ring that doorbell? We're going to get answers to those questions and too many others in today's episode of Break the Chains with our guest, Chris Edrington. He's our expert, and for years, Chris had struggled with heroin addiction. He eventually became a resident in a sober house in Los Angeles, where he was first exposed to the recovery residence model. And in 2001, he opened a sober living home in Minnesota. And that eventually grew into his current business, which is St. Paul Sober Living. It encompasses 12 properties in Minnesota and Colorado. Chris is vice president of the Minnesota Association of Sober Homes, which he helped found, and he's on the board of the National Alliance of Recovery Residences. Chris has been sober for 15 years, by the way. Welcome, Chris.
Hi there.
So good to have you on the call today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, in 15 years, that's, I tried to remember even what fashions I was wearing 15 years ago, but I think the world has changed a lot in 15 years.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's get right into the most basic question I have here, and that is, what is a recovery residence?
Well, it's somewhat of a term, of a newer term that's been tossed around in my view, but in a general sense, it's anything that's less than treatment. It's a structured living environment based on recovery, which houses, I'm sure, several people and not just a couple. But it's distinct from primary treatment, or in especially, you know, like a hospital setting or some primary care facility that's off in the, you know, out in the suburbs or way out outside of the urban area. I think recovery residences, by most of them, are within a residential area, is what I'm trying to say.
Is it an umbrella term which encompasses things like halfway houses and sober houses?
Mm-hmm. Yes, halfway house is really, the corrections really sort of owns that term, in my opinion. It's more of their side of halfway back to society sort of connotation, which I've never really liked in terms of addiction, because I don't think any of us are halfway or three quarters of the way anywhere. We're all trying to do something, you know, and we just are where we are. But yes, and from the NAR, or National Alliance for Recovery Residents viewpoint, there are essentially, in a general sense, four levels beneath treatment. And that could, in terms of what most people are aware of, that can be anything from a very loosely operated sober house where people just live together and there's a rule about no using, to a structured transitional living or extended care program, or what used to be called a halfway house.
So what would levels 1, 2, 3, and 4 just specifically be, just briefly about each one?
Well, you can see them on the NAR website, NARR online.org, I believe it is. Mm-hmm. But in a general sense, level one would be a sober living, purely sober living with no clinical services whatsoever, you know, some oversight and not a whole lot of structure. And there, and then this, a level two would probably be a similar environment, but with much more strict rules, probably a live-in manager, house meetings every week and that kind of thing. And then a level three would probably start to introduce some sort of services, like maybe there's a case manager, or maybe there's some food that's brought in, or maybe there's some, connection to an outpatient where they're living in this residence, but they're taken to the outpatient service on a daily basis or something. And then a level four would be all the way up to, you know, what looks like treatment light or extended care or halfway house or after treatment,
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Is that a question that you would ask a potential recovery residents, what level they are? I mean, is everybody going to even know the answer to that question?
Well, see, I think that's what's coming. I think NAR is a very new organization, and I think that, you know, given the general attitude and the general idea of what, you know, how to treat people in recovery and how to what works is to extend the connection to services and extend the, you know, treatment's not really the right word, but to extend the process. In other words, don't just go to a, you know, 1 month of services in a building where they throw tons of services at you for 30 days and then, you know, plop you out the door. Rather, spend the whole year getting the services that you need, and it would probably tear down in terms of intensity. In other words, you go to treatment for a month and then maybe to an extended care and then maybe to a sober living level, you know, or a recovery residence level three or two, three or four, and then maybe down to a level one, and then before you get your own apartment. And that's a much better overall program and overall process in terms of staying connected to some kind of service and being involved in your recovery and still essentially being treated for a longer period of time. That could be a 9 month course right there.
Mm-hmm. So it's just stepping down. That would be ideal. You get into the level four, where there's a tremendous amount of structure, oversight, support, and then you move down the line. And level one is, if you're functioning really well in level one, then you may be ready to be out on your own.
Exactly. And those different levels of programs, they exist out there. It isn't that every recovery residence is all out there with a big number one, two, or three, or four on their front door. But this is the overall idea of I think what's coming.
And that's ideal, really, for someone to not just, as you said, to leave treatment and all of a sudden they're out in the big bad world. And if they're gradually stepping down, that is probably a good, and it's a good course that will ensure, or maybe not ensure, but at least help to ensure continued sobriety.
People do much better when they stay connected and they stay involved in their recovery and receiving help at as the levels progress down over a period of several months to a year in the beginning.
And I think that's a really important point to make, because a lot of times people will come out of a 30-day program and their attitude is, oh, I've got this now. I don't
exactly.
really need it. I can handle this, because they just haven't really been back in the world sober in such a long time, or abstinent, that they don't realize what kind of challenges they're going to be facing, and then they get out there and they find out, whoa, I can't handle this.
Exactly. I use that line all the time. I speak at Hazelden and other treatment centers often, and I've even said to the group, I've said, how many people been here in this treatment center before at whatever treatment center I'm at? And they'll raise their hand, and I'll say, how many people when they left here last time thought to themselves, I got this? And they raise their hand sort of sheepishly, and, you know, because they're back.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good way to put it. I mean, it's sad that that's the case. Most people don't do well who go directly back to whatever their surroundings were. And in my experience, people do much better when they stay in the system longer.
Mm-hmm. And recovery is a process. And once people understand that, they can, it's really like protecting yourself, getting yourself in an environment where you do have plenty of support and structure until you're ready. But sometimes, as we know, it takes more than one try for, as you say, for people that you talk to in those rehab centers to understand. So what would you say is the role of the sober community in the early recovery process?
I think it's crucial. And for years, what St. Paul Sober Living has done is we've focused in our sober living operation on just that, like on that name itself. We are sober living. We're not sober housing. And the shift came for me and our homes some years ago when I realized that the people who were making it were the people who were part of the community. And that can come from so many different levels. Wherever you find your niche and your way in to this community, if you keep trying and you keep trying to enter into it in different ways, you will find your niche and your comfort zone. So I'm I make a lot of noise about the sober community when I talk at treatment centers and when I talk to my residents and my staff and even parents. I say this is all about the community. When you talk to, say for example, a 24-year-old kid who's got 2 years sobriety, or and you see him at a meeting getting a recognition, say for 2 years, and so that means he started at 22 and he's 24 and he's got 2 years. When he stands up there to talk about, here's what I did and here's I've got my 2 years, he invariably will talk about the other people, the relationships, and what he's been doing in the community. That's what you hear from people who are engaged in this thing. What's working for me are, and they'll talk about different elements like the relationships with people or I'm better at having a job. I'm a better son. I'm a better brother. It all comes out of the community because you have to be around people watching them have success and see other people making decisions that don't work out. And just like anything else, the culture of recovery is where things really start to penetrate and you start to wrap your heart around this thing of being in recovery as opposed to just being in, you can't be in treatment forever, you know? So the community, this is our thing and this is where our little part of the process is what we do. And I love talking about it, obviously.
So the recovery residents you see as a huge component of being in the sober community?
Yes, I think that you should be involved in the community as soon as you possibly can. Now, obviously, in the beginning, if you've come off of an enormous run with what we refer to, people being out on a run using drugs or doing whatever, some of those are really awful. You know, some people come from horrid situations, have been in horrible situations for many, many weeks or months, and they come out and they need to go to treatment and it's triage. I mean, and get some, sleep and food and some support and get healthy before they can wrap their head around being sober. But as soon as you're ready, I think you should be part of the community as soon as you can.
Does a good recovery residence make available those opportunities or encourage them or actually create them?
Exactly, yes. Say, for example, bringing in people from the community to speak at the treatment center or meet the residents of the house or, having a public AA meeting in the building where you get to meet people who are out there doing it, right? And the conversation with a good sponsor or a good counselor is always about what is this going to look like? What is it going to look like when you get out of here? Because most of those structured care places are, 90 days tops, right? So eventually you've got to live somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I really like the idea that, the goal should be sober living, not just sober housing.
Okay. And that would be a characteristic, I would think, of a good recovery residence then, where the community, the sober community activities is encouraged or maybe even required. Do your homes require this?
Yeah. In our houses, we're always asking you, where are you making connections and what are you doing with your time? In our particular program, it's a very schedule-driven program. It comes from an idea of where are you most of your week? In early sobriety, I always used to tell and I still do with my own sponsees or my residents, I'm a lot more interested in where you are than where your head is in the early months, especially in the early weeks and months of recovery. Because if you're in the right place, you're getting the right messages, and you're at least in the right area, you know, in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Because your head will catch up.
So a good recovery residence is going to make sure that you are exposed to that
right.
community.
And provide you opportunities, like take you out to meetings, you know, and get you involved, bring people in to speak. And the more you, as you progress down in recovery residence to a less structured environment, the more the community becomes a big part of it.
Right.
And if you've done it correctly, you've got a bunch of people around you that you are spending time with in the community, and that becomes your structure.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, listen, it's time to take a short break now, but stay tuned. We'll be right back with more interesting conversation with our guest, Chris Edrington, after these messages.
Is there someone you love who is suffering from alcohol or drug addiction? Do you feel like you simply don't know where to turn? We at Addiction Recovery Helpline know how painful it can be for both your loved one and for you and your family. We also realize that it's never easy to send someone you care about into rehab, but it's easier when you partner with us. Let Addiction Recovery Helpline assist your adult loved one to break the chains of addiction by finding just the right treatment center to meet their needs. Call us today toll-free at 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844-2-BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. It's too important to wait even one more day to make that call. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or on the web at getsobernow.net. Most insurance plans accepted.
If you're an adult suffering from drug or alcohol addiction, why not make today the day that you break the chains? At New Life Addiction Treatment Center in Port St. Lucie, Florida, we know it's not easy to pick up the phone and make that call. But remember, the caring staff at New Life is here to help. Count on us to partner with you to guide you towards getting your life back. Our confidential residential program takes most insurance plans and is designed to help meet your unique needs. Write this number down and give New Life Addiction Treatment Center a call right now. The toll-free number is 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844-2-BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. Your life is waiting for you, and so are we. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or getsobernow.net.
And now, back to Gwen Cardin on Break the Chains.
Welcome back to Break the Chains and today's topic, Recovery Residences. Our guest today is Chris Edrington, and we are going to move into a little discussion about the different types of recovery residences, not specifically levels, as we were talking about a minute ago, but some options that are available in different areas that have to do with gender, sexual orientation, parenting, that kind of thing. Chris, tell us just a little bit about the options that your company has for people.
St. Paul Sober Living has a dozen houses in Minnesota and in Colorado. So in St. Paul, we have 5 houses for men, 3 houses for women. They're very, very distinct that we don't mix genders in our houses. And then we have a house in Minneapolis in the uptown area for the LGBT community. And it's a primarily gay men's house, but it's open to LGBT, and we let generally the group decide because we do a process of interviewing anyway. So if you want to enter the house, you have to sit down with the current residents and interview. So they can decide.
You said that you do not mix genders. Why is that?
Because it creates problems. There's nothing like there's nothing more, in terms of a deterrent of your focus, like a relationship in early recovery. And I know that everyone hears about that, like stay out of relationships for the first year. The reality of it is that there's hopefully like a fire that's burning in you that you want to make some change. changes. Like, you have learned about your disease. You know you've had consequences. You showed up to treatment. You're in this thing. You're like, you know what? I know there's a problem, and I want to make some changes, and I want to fix some things. And that fire gets snuffed out the minute you get into a relationship because it almost replaces it. It gives you a sense of comfort, and that fire goes down, and then you start to half do the program, and you get nothing from half measures. You got to be all into this thing. So that, to me, is the general reason to stay out of relationships. And when you're in the process of doing this, you know, in early recovery, it's uncomfortable. And people are quick to look for quick comfort, you know, and there's nothing like having another person think that you hung the moon to make you suddenly feel better about yourself, you know?
And distract you from your sobriety. And
oh, it's very, yeah, incredibly distracting. I've had residents, you know, sitting here in my office, and I look right at them and I say, you know, what's her name? Or what's his name? And they say, what do you mean? I say, well, we lost you weeks ago. So who is it? We lost your focus and we can see it, you know, and you're, one of the things we do too in the houses regularly is at the house meeting in particular, and in a general sense all the time, is we're asking the other members of the house, how's he doing? How's she doing? And they will tell you. They will say, she's great. He's great. Or, you know what? I'm not sure what's going on because she's not around as much as she used to be, or he, you know, or he isn't. And that's sort of the first sign. Like, where are you? Because one of our biggest rules is you've got to be here and engaged with us as a group. This is your group of people, and you got to be here and with us day to day.
And I would assume at a level three or four, those questions would be more frequently asked than somebody in a level one where they're just pretty much on their own. Or but does a good recovery resident keep an eye on that thing regardless of their level?
Yeah, I would say from level four down to three, they're definitely separated. Mm-hmm. And because they might be in the same building in a level four and three. But because that might be more of a structured transitional living or extended care program with counselors and a clinical team, and they'll definitely keep them separated in the same building and not even sharing the same cafeteria in some instances.
Go ahead.
When you get down to sober living, when you come out of what, you know, still has elements of a clinical program and you're into a regular sober house or, you know, a high or a strictly run sober house, that I wouldn't, and I know there's a few out there and there aren't many, but I wouldn't be a fan of mixing genders, period, at all at that level.
One of the things that challenges women in getting help for addictions is that oftentimes they have children, they have domestic responsibilities, and it's hard for them to even get into rehab if they don't have someone to take care of their children. What about if they do need to get into a recovery residence and they have children? Are there residences that accommodate that?
There are. There are very few of them that I'm aware of. There used to be one here in Minnesota, and I don't believe it still goes on. The one that I think Hazelden actually owned it for a while. And I get asked this at least once a year. When are you going to do women and children? And to be honest with you, I wish I could, and I would love to do it, because it is a big, you know, barrier to entry for a lot of people. It has some logistic problems in terms of our model. In other words, if we took one of our sober houses that has 4, 5, 6 bedrooms and 8 or 10 people, excuse me, living there, we would probably have to bring that down to, you know, maybe 4 in order to accommodate the children. Mm-hmm. And the whole model gets sort of messed up in terms of, you know, the functionality of the house. One of the critical things about a sober living house critical mass. In other words, a sober house with only 4 residents is difficult to create community, you know, just by the virtue of the fact that you can come home from work and no one will be home. Mm-hmm. If you live with 10 people, it's almost always the case that somebody's there and you walk in the door and they're going to see you, and you can't walk in the back door and go up to your room and not be seen. So, but on a, I would love to get into that model, and I've looked into it a few times over the years here, and there's not enough of them. And I, like I said, I get asked all the time about women and children sober living.
Well, this field is so quickly evolving now, and it probably will be addressing specific needs such as women's issues more in the future than it has in the past. Because
no, I agree. I think it's coming for sure.
Mm-hmm. What would you say are the qualities of a good recovery residence? And what's at the? My question is: a lot of times people don't have transportation. They don't have support from home. They don't have good living skills. I mean, what types of things can one expect from a recovery residence?
Well, I think that when you're leaving treatment, say you're leaving a primary treatment center, your counselor is essentially making an assessment or some team of counselors about what you need to do next. So there's a treatment plan. There's an aftercare plan for you. And for some people, you know, it might be as simple as, you know, you've been to treatment a bunch of times and you know what to do, and we're sending you to a sober house because you've done treatment so many times. We're not sending you to another extended care, or you're brand new and you've never done this and you really need a little bit more than a month, and you can extend here at primary for some big primary centers will extend you for 3 months. But they'll typically send you out the door having rated you in it, you know, and say, this is what you need next. And we often, and as a matter of fact, about 2.5 years ago, we developed a new program here at St. Paul Sober Living. We call it the Plus Program. And it's a super sober house. It has a case manager. It has a lot of transportation assistance and medication management and money management. And we developed it because we were getting people out of treatment centers who were not ready for sober living. It was too loose. It was too self-directed. And, you know, from anything from grocery shopping to spending money to making it to meetings to getting girlfriends and boyfriends, we would lose these guys or these girls in 2 weekends because they couldn't follow the rules or many, many reasons. So we developed this new program where we try to catch those hot spots. We put certain things in place like medication management and money management and transportation to, say, your therapists and your outpatient so that we know you're making it. And then after that, you transition down to a less structured sober house. And then in our case, there are 3 levels, and you eventually in the 3rd level are in what is essentially traditional sober living.
Mm-hmm. So you need to ask a lot of questions pertaining to your particular situation and find something where you're going to get the support that you need. I don't know whether sometimes a sober house will say, oh, yes, we'll take you to work, but then they're not really set up with good transportation. I mean, so what?
No, really, that meant that one of your roommates will probably drive you if you ask him nicely, right?
Oh, okay.
It's really a level of care. You know, a lot of parents need to get educated about, well, what is really this level of care that my son is going to? Is it a sober house? Is it more than a sober house? You know, the old version of a sober house, the old archaic version for a lot of people was, you know, good luck. Here's a bed, here's a pillow, here's a dresser, and go to meetings and don't drink and pay your rent and good luck. Mm-hmm. You know, in my opinion, those days are over. I mean, there's a different community. There's a lot of younger people coming through treatment, and they're living a very, very dangerous lifestyle. Some of these young kids who are going through the pills and then on to heroin, they're super dangerous. I mean, not to be dramatic, but these are the kids that are, you know, overdosing in their parents' basements. These are the ones that I'm seeing more and more and more. And they need a lot more help after treatment to get prepared to enter the community, because they can't stay in structured care forever. So when a parent is looking for the next level, you know, take what the counselor says and get online and do your own research and figure out, oh, well, this place offers this and this place offers this. There are a lot of transitional living places and extended cares that are beautiful places, but they're nowhere near the sober community. They have wonderful cafeterias and wonderful counselors and fantastic high-quality extended care treatment, but they're not anywhere near the community, and so they're going to eventually leave there. And eventually you've got to be in the community and establish yourself there.
Good. Well, that is really good information. We need to take another break right now, but we'll continue our discussion about recovery residences in just a couple of minutes, so don't go away.
Is there someone you love who is suffering from alcohol or drug addiction? Do you feel like you simply don't know where to turn? We at Addiction Recovery Helpline know how painful it can be for both your loved one and for you and your family. We also realize that it's never easy to send someone you care about into rehab, but it's easier when you partner with us. Let Addiction Recovery Helpline assist your adult loved one to break the chains of addiction by finding just the right treatment center to meet their needs. Call us today toll-free at 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844-2-BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. It's too important to wait even one more day to make that call. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or on the web at getsobernow.net. Most insurance plans accepted.
If you're an adult suffering from drug or alcohol addiction, why not make today the day that you break the chains? At New Life Addiction Treatment Center in Port St. Lucie, Florida, we know it's not easy to pick up the phone and make that call. But remember, the caring staff at New Life is here to help. Count on us to partner with you to guide you towards getting your life back. Our confidential residential program takes most insurance plans and is designed to help meet your unique needs. Write this number down and give New Life Addiction Treatment Center a call right now. The toll-free number is 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844-2-BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. Your life is waiting for you, and so are we. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or getsobernow.net.
Welcome back to Break the Chains. Here again, your host, Gwen Cardin.
Before we resume, I'd like to stress that I really truly do enjoy receiving feedback and ideas from listeners, and I would especially like to hear from you. So if you would, take a couple of minutes after the show to email me your ideas and comments or contact me on Facebook. You can get my contact information on the show page, but I will give it to you right now. The email is addictionradioshow@gmail.com. Facebook page is www.facebook.com/breakthechains1. So we invite you to like our page and come back often. We're talking today to Chris Edrington about recovery residences. And before the break, Chris, you referred several times to parents. I am imagining that you hear a lot of parents or hear from a lot of parents who are looking for these residences because we have the heroin epidemic and most of the people are young people. And I was wondering what you would say if a parent came to you and said, Chris, what are the questions that I need to ask before I put my child into a recovery residence? What absolutely do I need the answers to? What would those questions be?
I would say the first thing you would want to do if you're, you know, take the list of options that your counselor gave you or gave your child and research them online. And say, for example, it's some sober house in California or a transitional living or extended care in Ohio, and look up and call them and ask them questions. And I would ask them questions like, is this a place where they are going to meetings on their own or involved in the sober community? Is it mostly self-directed, or is there somebody that's really – in other words, what's the level of oversight? Is there somebody in the house? Is somebody drug testing my kid? Is somebody going to know if he's taking his medications or not? This is a lot of important stuff to understand. And most of the reputable places will belong to some kind of an association. There'll be some sort of state organization. Like in Minnesota, there's MASH, the Minnesota Association of Sober Homes. Now, more like an extended care in Minnesota would not necessarily be part of MASH, and they would have oversight by some other entity. But my first questions would be, what is the level of oversight? What is the level of structure? And tell me what are those things? Okay, there's a live-in manager. There's a strict curfew. There's drug testing every so often. When I hear about drug testing, at sober houses, and they say random only, that generally means they test when somebody says, oh, hey, we better test this guy. Well, in my opinion, that's way too late. I think you should test consistently every week, every month, every 2 weeks, and don't tell them when, and just do it all the time, and they get used to it. And
that's interesting that we do random drug testing. That to me, I would think, gee, that's good because they're never going to know. I didn't realize though what the code is for that. So that's good to know.
Yeah, random generally means whenever I think about it. And I'm not a big fan of it. And I do push a little harder on some of the other sober houses that are still sort of an older model of hands off. And I'm not, I'm a little bit, we're quite a bit stricter and we test a lot. So, and then I would ask questions like, what happens when, if my kid is asked to leave? What actually are the reasons for discharge? What am I to expect? Are you going to drive him to a hotel? Are you going to stick him out on the sidewalk with his bags and let him stand there until he gets a ride? Give me a day in the life of the place. Now, obviously, the best case scenario is go look, right? Mm-hmm. Go look. Go walk in the door of the house, meet the residents, meet the manager. And obviously, we can't always do that. So these days, parents are poking around a lot more than they used to, and we invite it.
Well, are there ways that you can check up on the reputation of a recovery resident?
Yes. You can check to see if they're part of a state alliance or association like MASH or like GAR, which is Georgia, or FAR, which is Florida. And they're coming up. There's lots of them coming up. There's a big sober living network in Los Angeles run by some guys who really know what they're talking about with sober living and all the levels underneath the umbrella of NAR. So get online and start to poke around and find out what you can. And if you call the house or the place where your son is going to go or your daughter's going to go and nobody returns your call or nobody's answering your call, then I would go somewhere else. I would, just like any other sort of service, there's certain elements that, I'm always talking to my staff about. I'm like, look, moms want to know. They want to know what's going on with their kid and they want to know what the status is. And we need to be there and tell them, and we need to know what we're talking about. In other words, I tell my staff all the time, I don't want to get a call from a parent and our answer is, I don't know, I haven't seen your kid in 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
So.
But what about privacy?
You mean like the anonymity thing?
Right.
To me, that's a giant pain. I think it's just annoying that, it's an archaic vision of, oh my God, my neighbors are going to find out I don't drink. And I get it that people have rights to and that's understandable. And you can do whatever you want with your name. And I wouldn't, broadcast that you were in one of my houses. We don't do that. But sometimes that's over the top, If a parent calls and I'm going to tell you what I know about your daughter and I'm going to tell you, and if you're – and our residents know that if you test with us and you test positive, we're going to call your parents immediately.
Even though they're over 18?
Oh, yeah. And you sign a document that says that.
Oh, okay.
And, I've had, adults throw a fit and say, you can't tell my parents. I'm like, why not? This is a deadly disease. Why wouldn't I? What are they going to say if something happens to you and I didn't tell them?
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy. I mean, I think that whole anonymity thing gets a little bit blown out of proportion. And I respect the old tenets of AA, but a sober living house is not AA. AA exists completely separately. Sometimes people get a little bit where the lines get sort of blurry there. And, I think that this is a very, very deadly progressive disease. I mean, take it very seriously. And I don't pull any punches when it comes to telling the truth about what's going on and being transparent with families about what's going on.
And that would be a good thing to hear from anyone running a recovery residence that you're considering.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned a few minutes ago that if you should call the recovery residence and nobody answers, that's not a good sign. What are some other red flags, things that are really just should tell you to go away and keep looking?
One, that they're not testing. Maybe that it's co-ed. you know, that their meetings, the accessibility to meetings is too cumbersome. Like, you really can't get there. I mean, it should be so easy to get to meetings from the sober. And I'm talking mostly about sober living, because when you're talking about, you know, recovery residents under the NAR umbrella have these four levels, but in there's a lot of different versions of what somebody would call a recovery residence. Anything that's a structured, you know, licensed facility with clinicians is going to be following HIPAA and all kinds of other structured laws and state guidelines. And so if you call up, they're going to say, I can't confirm or deny that that person lives here. And they're going to be following a lot of state guidelines. But once you get down to levels 1 and 2, and maybe even 3 in some cases, these are typically sober living houses. Even though they're under the umbrella of recovery residents, which is essentially the new term, they're not going to have oversight by a state organization. They're going to be run by the individuals that are the operators.
Mm-hmm. So what would definitely be a turnoff? And you said in addition to not regularly drug testing, to not answering the phone, to not making sure people get to meetings or geographically close to where meetings are occurring, is there anything else that would?
I guess I would say in the most profound one I can come up with is, if you called, say, after your brother or sister or son or daughter was in this sober house for, say, a month, and you called and said, I want to talk to the manager. Tell me about my son. Tell me what's going on with him. He should be able to tell you, or she should be able to tell you. Oh, yeah, you know, he's working at the drugstore, or he's working at the hardware store, or, you know, he's on the softball team, or, oh, yeah, I know Mike, or I know, you know, Julie. I know she does this, or she works there. They should be able to tell you. There should be some consistent exposure to each other. It's a big part of what we do in our house meetings is, let's talk. Everybody should know what's going on with each other. And I don't ever want to hear, like I said earlier, I don't know. I never see her. I don't know. I never see him. That's a bad sign.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because then the accountability comes from transparency and involvement, right? If you're involved and you know, we know you're here. I'm always asking my residents, is this guy committed? Is he getting connected? And they're like, oh, yeah, man, he's one of us. He's with us all the time. He's in the gang. It's like a horrible comparison to the old fraternity. But when, you know, my brother was in a fraternity in Boulder in the University of Colorado, and, you know, those guys were ridiculous about the unity of the group and, you know, the priority of the house, and you live and die for your fraternity, you know. But I like that concept in the sober house. I love the unity of the guys. Unity is our big push.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, very good. And sometimes the houses are run by, I think it's called peer-to-peer. So it would be someone who is in recovery who's just opened a house. And sometimes I think there are higher levels of people who are running those houses. Can you talk about that distinction? And there might be pluses or minuses with each one.
Yeah, if somebody were to call me and say, I'm going to open a sober house, will you help me? And I get it all the time. I would say, how long have you been sober and who's going to run this thing? And if you say, I've been sober for 6 months, I'm saying, I'm sorry, I'm not going to help you. So generally the owner of the property is one in recovery and wants to be part of this and has the means to do it. Or there's an owner and then there's an operator. Maybe there's just a real estate owner, but then there's an operator within that has all the right intentions and wants to do it right. I've helped many people get started with it, and I've helped several who did it really, really well and followed everything I suggested. And then I've gotten, like I said, those calls where, you know, hey man, I just got out of treatment. I think I can do this, and I'm gonna open one, you know, with my dad's money. And it usually doesn't ever come off, but sometimes it does, and then they don't last.
So I think it would be good to find out then who owns the residence and who's operating it, and what is their background, what is their experience,
exactly.
do they have any degrees, do they have any training in addictions?
Right.
I think somebody who just thinks it would be a good idea for some extra income, and I know there are those places, that's probably not going to be the best place that's going to be the most professional.
And again, we're probably talking about sober housing and sober living, not a structured extended care, because you don't get out of treatment and open an extended care treatment center, you know. But in the organization like MASH and the state organizations that are state associations that themselves are a member of NAR, we do things, in other words, like in MASH, we do manager training twice a year in October and May. And I usually actually run it because I'm on the board. I'm the vice president. So all the managers from the different sober houses that are new that have never done it come every year, October and May, and they sit and listen to, and I tell them things like, here's when you should test and here's how you do this and here's how you do that. And there's certain things that MASH requires. So an owner and an operator might be different, but somebody's got to have some time and know what they're doing, or we wouldn't allow them to join.
Great. Well, it's that time again when we have to take a quick break from the show, but stay tuned and we'll be right back.
If you're an adult suffering from drug or alcohol addiction, why not make today the day that you break the chains? At New Life Addiction Treatment Center in Port St. Lucie, Florida, we know it's not easy to pick up the phone and make that call. But remember, the caring staff at New Life is here to help. Count on us to partner with you to guide you towards getting your life back. Our confidential residential program takes most insurance plans and is designed to help meet your unique needs. Write this number down and give New Life Addiction Treatment Center a call right now. The toll-free number is 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844, the number 2, BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. Your life is waiting for you, and so are we. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or getsobernow.net.
Is there someone you love who is suffering from alcohol or drug addiction? Do you feel like you simply don't know where to turn? We at Addiction Recovery Helpline know how painful it can be for both your loved one and for you and your family. We also realize that it's never easy to send someone you care about into rehab, but it's easier when you partner with us. Let Addiction Recovery Helpline assist your adult loved one to break the chains of addiction by finding just the right treatment center to meet their needs. Call us today, toll free, at 1-844-2-BE-SOBER. That's 844, the number 2, BE-SOBER. Or contact us on the web at getsobernow.net. It's too important to wait even one more day to make that call. Call 1-844-2-BE-SOBER or on the web at getsobernow.net. Most insurance plans accepted.
You're listening to Break the Chains, America's top radio source of information for people struggling with drug or alcohol addiction. Here's your host, Gwen Cardin.
Before we resume talking about recovery residences, just want to add one more time that I'd love to hear from you. Your listeners, the listeners are very important to the success of the show, and I love to have your feedback and ideas. So please take a moment to get in touch with me. Before the break, we were talking about some of the red flags and the things that people need to ask before they come in to a recovery residence. I would like to know from the other side of that, Chris, who is appropriate for recovery residents and who maybe isn't?
Well, I think obviously the counselor from your primary treatment center is going to determine that. But then again, there are people who come into recovery residences, and that obviously includes sober houses, from, say, you know, from the street, so to speak. So in other words, like earlier we were talking about people who come out of treatment and say, I got this, and they go home and it doesn't work. And then within a month, they face plant. They stop going to meetings. They stop doing everything. And they're looking to, okay, I'll do it now. I don't want to go all the way back to treatment. What can I do? Can I back up the continuum, you know, less than all the way back up? And that's where we come in. That's where these, you know, okay, now I'll go to the transitional living, or now I'll go to the extended care or sober house. And if you haven't been out there too long, then we'll talk to you and we'll look at you. But primarily, there's an assessment made by your counselor leaving treatment about level of care, where you, what you need and where you need to go. But I will take a hard look at just about anybody, especially if you've been to primary treatment within the last 6 months, then I'll take a look at you. And I really want to know what you've been doing in the last few weeks and months, because if you've been out there really trying, then I think I can probably help you with the community in the structure of this, of the recovery residence or sober house. If you've been out there just using and not really trying to get sober, and you've just been out there face down in the ditch, then you probably need to go to treatment first.
Well, and there are people who go to a recovery residence and they bring in drugs and they get kicked out, or they break some other kind of a rule and they get kicked out. Is this something that you're going to take a hard look at?
Yeah, we get calls all the time from someone who has been kicked out of a different one, right? And I hopefully get information from the other staff at the other place will call us and say, here's why we kicked them out, here's what happened, because the resident will tell you anything. Oh, they kicked me out for because I was late one night. And the reality of it is that they kicked you out because you're never home and you were never engaged and you just didn't care and everybody knew it. Mm-hmm. And so when I interview you, I'm going to say, tell me about your commitment to this. Tell me what you've been doing. I can tell if you're committed to this by what you've been doing over the last few months. But as you can understand, the consequences start to build on these behaviors. Even if you're not using, if you're just half doing this thing in the community, it's pretty brutal. Life doesn't show up for people who are half doing this thing. Whether you don't necessarily have to relapse to have not much of a life. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Is it the responsibility of the recovery residence staff to make sure that the person they're bringing in is clean, is not a criminal? I mean, how much can you expect? How much screening can you expect for the other residents?
Well, if we did a background check like, say, they would do for an apartment or a job at a big corporation, we wouldn't have any residents because they have, credit problems and unlawful detainers and horrible rental histories and horrible job performance and horrible financial issues and some general, some criminal stuff. It's usually not that bad. The most important thing is, in my mind, is judging commitment and motivation to be clean and sober. What I often tell people is you should be running a program in your sober house or recovery residence where people are knocking on the door saying, I need to do what you guys are doing in here. That's what I need. Mm-hmm. I need this. My counselor told me I should have done it last time. My friends are all telling me I should do it now, and I need this. I've got a girl who's been calling me the last couple of weeks who's been struggling out there, and she was told to do a sober house several months ago, and she didn't do it. And she keeps, it's like trying to go up the down escalator. She keeps trying to get up. She's getting nowhere. And every time she calls, she's more and more and more willing to do what we're asking her to do. And I think she's going to come in, and if she survives, she'll do it.
Mm-hmm. But if I'm sending my child to a recovery residence, I want to make sure that if someone is in there who does start using or does get into trouble with the law, that they're not going to just keep being invited back and creating a poor environment. I would think that would be one thing you'd want to know.
I think that that's a big issue. And people, when there's a zero tolerance in most of these programs, when someone else is using in the house, the first question I have from the staff is, did it involve anybody else? Did they go off and use and then come home and then we knew they were high? Or did they bring it into the house and involve others? So I'll tell you this. I got a little bit of flack from some of my referents, years ago when I started not throwing people away for minor infractions of the rules. Where, say, for example, I've had a kid and he's in a sober house and he's doing great for 3, 4, 5 months, goes home for Christmas, hooks up with his old buddies, and the joint comes around and he hits it once and he's like, oh my God, what did I do? And he calls and tells on himself, or he comes home and says, you guys, I can't believe I did this. It scared me to death. I did this. I'm not throwing that kid away. I'm going to try to keep him. And the first question I'm going to say to the rest of the group, do you guys want to keep him? Do you think he's telling the truth? They're like, and if they say, yeah, he just made a dumb error, then I'm probably going to keep him. And in the beginning, years ago, I've been doing this for years. Now, obviously, I don't want to say that, we let people relapse. It's a slippery slope. We make very conscientious, comprehensive decisions because we can, because we have the oversight, because we know the intricacies of the group, and we've made decisions like that in the past. But I think that, a zero tolerance policy is absolutely where to start from.
And it sounds like there's some democracy involved in a well-run home.
There you go. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's really healthy to put as much democracy in it as you can.
Good. Now, we only have about 2 more minutes but how much does it cost to be in one of these residences? I know it can vary with level of care and location and that kind of thing, but I'm sure people want to get some idea whether it's even affordable for them in their situation.
The bare-bones sober house with a live-in manager or maybe not and a lot of hands-off sort of model is probably, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of $400 to $500 to $600 a month in the Midwest and probably $900 to $1,000 on the West Coast and East Coast. I'm sort of all over the place, but you know, in my opinion, you don't get much for that. You know, and I also don't agree necessarily with paying, you know, $2,000 a month because you get your own room and it has a deck and it's on the beach. Those things don't contribute to the sobriety part. But then you get all the way up to an extended care program that could be $7,000 to $12,000 a month. But those are going to be, those are essentially treatment, you know, or treatment light. So when you get down there, the reality of it is that, you know, you either are paying your own way or you're not. And I often tell parents who have probably paid a lot of money out for different treatments for their kids and they're tired of paying for stuff. And I say, well, why don't you get them in the door and pay for 3 months and then you pay half for 3 months but we will hold him or her accountable to start to contribute to their own as much as they can and from their own work, from their own money.
Okay. Well, that is all we have time for today, and I hope that you're now much better informed about what to look for when choosing a recovery residence. And I want to thank our guest, Chris Edrington, for taking time out of his busy day to be on the show. Chris, would you please tell listeners how they can contact you and find out more about your business and your everything that you're doing in this field?
Sure. You can go online to stpaulsoberliving.com, either S.T. Paul or S-A-I-N-T Paul. Either way, you'll find us. Or you can call us at 651-636-SPSL, which is 7775. We'd be glad to help you. And we'd also help you find another place if we're not appropriate. We have a lot of resources about different levels of care all over the country. And I go to conferences every year, and I know just about all of them. So if you're looking to place your loved one and you need some assistance, we'd be glad to help.
Great. Well, we are out of time right now. I look forward to being with you again next Thursday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time when our topic will be how to restart your recovery if you've gotten off track. So for now, this is your host, Gwen Carden. Be safe, live smart, and most of all, take good care of yourself.